with you. Good morning. How's everyone doing? Glad to be here with you. Let's open up to Daniel chapter 7. That Bible question almost encapsulated the entire class today. Babylon's going down, and she ain't coming back. But she is also a type that represents the world trying to run its agenda against God. Okay? And so when God puts a nation down, it's going to stay down. Okay? And then when he implements a kingdom that's eternal, it's eternal. Okay? And that really is what's happening here in Daniel chapter 7. Okay? Now we think about it. We've been introduced to four beasts in this chapter, and we saw that those run parallel with the parts of the statue from chapter 2. Okay? So what's a little bit different here is the statue was struck by a rock in Daniel chapter 2. And then that rock grows into a kingdom that covers the whole earth. And so you have God coming in, strikes the statue, turns into little pieces of chaff that blow away in the summer winds, and then God's kingdom is established. And that same exact thing is happening here in Daniel 7. All right? Now, the kingdoms are being introduced as critters rather than inanimate objects, and we talked a little bit about the significance of that, okay? But where we've made it up to, mostly here at verses 9 through 12, we're seeing the rock strike the statue is what we're reading here. We're reading the judgment of the nations. So the same thing is happening, it's just being done differently, okay? And then in verses 13 through 14, we'll see when kind of that event actually takes place as Jesus ascends to the throne, all right? So that's what's going on. I mean, that Bible question really encapsulated it, okay? This is a picture of the world kingdoms going down. Now, Babylon's a type, okay? But the thing we're supposed to learn here is the world's going to end, okay? But God's kingdom remains forever. All right. Now, I might repeat this part again, but just because the stone struck the statue, did that mean that world empires ceased to continue rising and falling? That's why there's 10. That's why there's 10 toes. That's why there's 10 horns. Okay. Even though God establishes his eternal kingdom, okay, and now people can be ushered into the kingdom of his beloved son, that doesn't mean that kingdoms are going to cease to rise and fall. But the lesson is still there. They will not survive. They will not, they're not eternal. They will all meet the same end that Babylon met. So if you're tracking up to this point then, we notice that one of the horns kind of takes on human-like characteristics, has the eyes of a man, starts uttering great boasts against God. And when you compare that to Revelation, you can see, I mean, it's someone who is, and parts of the New Testament, someone who is, I mean, what would be the boast that you could give against God? Right? How about, I am God? Right? That would be the ultimate boast against God. I mean, that's what got Satan in trouble, right? You know, wanted to be God. What got Nebuchadnezzar in trouble? You know, he thought he was God. Okay, so that would be the great boast. But so I got to repeat this later on this morning, but you notice that, okay, so 10 represents, you know, these kingdoms. I mean, there's going to be more kingdoms that come, and we don't have to be like, one, two, are we in the fourth or the fifth? You know, seven? I mean, we would never agree, one, You know, and that's not the purpose there. The purpose is even though the world kingdoms are judged and the statue turns into chaff and blows away, the kingdoms are going to continue to rise and fall. But Jesus' eternal kingdom has been established, which is the marker of the end of earthly kingdoms. They will meet the fate that Babylon has met. But in both these visions, we have a representation of 10. But the horns, one of them kind of starts acting a little bit differently. You know, different characteristics are given to it. And so what I notice is when that stone strikes the statue and Jesus does set up his kingdom, doesn't the book of Revelation tell us that Satan changes up his entire war tactics and switches from trying to stop entire nations, which is what he was doing before, right, and trying to destroy the nation of Israel? Satan stopped from trying to destroy entire nations, stop from trying to stop God's entire plan, which is this is the part that Kendall also said, if you heard this, and Satan switched to just targeting people individually. Okay? So that's what I really like about Daniel 7, is you see that switch. That although there's 10 horns and there will be kingdoms that continue to rise and fall, always in the face of God, there's a switch here where one of them specifically takes on eyes like a man and utters great boasts against God. Okay, you see the switch from Satan's warfare, from just being, you know, militant to almost psychological, where now he's really trying to weave the falsehoods and the false doctrines and the false religions and the false, okay? And he's always done these things, but he had to put all of his eggs in that basket, okay? So we'll do... We only have to read Revelation chapter 13 to recap our entire class last week. So we'll do that by first remembering in Daniel chapter 7, there's four beasts. The first one was like a lion. Second one was like a, third one was like a leopard. And the fourth one was like a, it just says dreadful and terrifying, right? It doesn't actually get like an animal qualifier. Lion, bear, leopard, dreadful 10 horns. Okay, so then we go to Revelation 13. In Daniel, the winds were stirring up the sea. Okay, and from the sea these creatures came. In Revelation chapter 13, the dragon, who is clearly identified as Satan in chapter 12, so Satan stood on the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea, having 10 horns. Hey, wait, didn't our dreadful beast have 10 horns? He did. 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. Wasn't one of the horns in Daniel uttering blasphemous things against God? Okay, yeah. The beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth was like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and his great authority. We can go back to Daniel chapter 7 here. So when we're reading Revelation, we have different beasts introduced in Revelation chapter 13. So now we can clearly identify the one that we just read as world government. Okay, how are we able to do that? Daniel chapter 7. That beast that we just read was a composite sketch of all of the beasts here in Daniel chapter 7 that represent their world kingdoms, their power, their government. All right? So that's what we got going on here. And then that's where we get to wait, because Revelation is yet to come. So, important to know that. All right, now let's pick up back here in Daniel chapter 7, verse 9. I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames, its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. Isn't this stuff cool? Well, I mean, do you wonder who the myriads and the thousands are? Do you think those are just angels? This is a good point to plug this in. So we're having to go through Daniel in a kind of a specific order because it's not chronological, right? So just because we're in chapter 7 doesn't mean chapter 7 itself is chronological. There's nothing chronological, okay, about certain sections of this, okay? You'll want to keep that in mind, you know, if someone hits me with a hard question a week or two from now, you know. Okay. Then verse 11. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. And I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away. But an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. This stuff fires me up. Because many of you, and I'm going to say all of you, understand the seriousness and the weight of the spiritual battle. And I can say all of you because you have to fight it in your own life. The flesh versus the spirit. So you read your Bible. You might even pray every day. And when you are wrong, you don't take vengeance into your own hand. And you forgive. And you do all the right things. And you wake up the next morning and Satan still continues to hurl everything he has at you. And you do everything right and everyone else around you continues to wrong you. Ever felt that? And you're just trying so hard to get yourself to heaven. And you finally get yourself in this position where you're like, you know, like, hey, you know, I kind of been set in my mind on the Spirit and on things above. And I've become a lot more patient and not as self-centered and been really feeling it's been a lot easier to forgive people. Then you could I maybe help somebody else learn these same things? So then you start to help other people. And then they just bang, they just smack you. And then they turn around and then they blame you. Right? Somehow it's your fault that their life's a wreck. Right? You're just trying to lead them to Christ. You know. I mean, I've had people write this congregation letters, how terrible I am, you know. What a terrible legalistic that I would teach water baptism, you know. I have not been physically punched in the face yet, but twice, if I hadn't left, I would have been. And that's not because I'm a smug jerk. That's because I said you have to have the Spirit to go to heaven. Right? Yeah. That story I remind you of, he's shaking so bad and he's got the fist cocked, you know. And he looks at me and he goes, "Why are you talking to me? Go talk to them." And he talks to the young, you know, goth looking couple that are, you know, making out on the couch. And I'm like, and that's just his picture, you know. You know. If you can, you know, he doesn't understand that this is an inside problem, not an outside problem. You know. "Why are you bugging me? Go talk to them." You know, he points to the, you know, every orifice of their face is pierced, you know. Apparently they need the gospel more than he needs it, was his thought, you know. That's pretty tough, isn't it? I mean, you finally get some spiritual momentum going in your life, and then you just, you try to help anybody, and then it just backfires, you know. They either punch you, or metaphorically punch you, or blame you. And then verse 11. Thousands are attending God. And we keep looking. And that sound of those boastful words, which that horn was speaking, guess what? They stop talking, don't they? Kept looking until that beast was slain. You know, that fires me up because you can do everything right in this life and the world will still hate you. You know, I wrote the front of house schedule for Texas Roadhouse for years when I was the service manager. During the summer when we were busy and we were ramped up, there were 100 employees that I had. And the majority of them servers, some hosts, bussers, bartenders, cleaning crew. And so I had to write a schedule for 100 people. And that thing killed me. It absolutely killed me. You know why it killed me? And I'm still trying to shed these parts of my personality today. Is I tried to make the schedule work perfect for all 100 people. I tried so hard. I must have written 100 schedules. Did I ever write one that everybody loved perfectly? But yet, like a naive person, every time I went into it thinking it was possible. Now, that comes from a good place inside me. I want to do the right thing and I want to make people happy. But at some point, you got to wake up and realize you can't make everybody happy, right? You can do everything right in this life and the world will still hate you. Did Jesus do everything perfect? Did the world love him? Nope, it hated him. Isaiah 53's got something to say about that, actually. So, that gives us great hope, though, doesn't it? Because when you're... Well, let's think about it this way. I've always heard the... I heard this new, I don't know, it's called the square root rule. So they say if you're working in a business, you take the square root of the number of employees, those are the number of employees who are doing 80% of the work. So if you've got nine employees, square root 3 are doing 80% of the work, right? If you got 100 employees, square root 10 are doing, 80% of the work. And that's generally pretty true. Okay, and you can see how, because that's growing exponentially, that as you get more and more and more people, the weight of the sheer number of people who aren't pulling their weight, you start to feel that a little bit more, right? So what do you think the square root rule is for those who are actually practicing righteousness on the earth? Like maybe square root like 1,000 times more? Like, okay, say there's 100,000 people in Billings. You know, how many of them are actually practicing righteousness according to the scriptures? Can you just take a square root of that? Probably square root it again, and then again, and then again, and again, and again. And you end up with a measly few hundred, you know? And those 100 are looking out, and they're feeling the weight of the other... I mean, what are these numbers, 99,900 people who aren't? Do you guys see the picture? Put yourself in a business where you're one of two people carrying all the weight for the other 10 employees. You ever been that person? Can you identify with that situation? Now compound that a million times more and be the 100 people in 100,000 that are actually carrying their spiritual weight. Is that a heavy burden? It's a heavy burden, isn't it? You know, every morning, and for whatever reason, it happens, and sometimes more than recently, I was glad to see Raj here, because every morning I walk in this building, I say to myself, self, what am I going to teach the kids if the person leading the opening doesn't show up? Because unfortunately, that's happened a few times over the past couple years. So I walked in this morning, I saw Emily, so I'm like, well, I'm sure Raj is here. But I still ask myself the same, what would I do if they didn't show up, you know? And I saw this podium and I thought, could I convince one of the kids to carry it? You know, like if I leaned it over, one of the bigger kids at opening, maybe Zoe, and she's a pretty tough girl. Could I get her to try to carry that thing on her back? And you see, and I was thinking that because Jesus tells us that we got to pick up our cross and follow him. That's a pretty big burden, isn't it? Now, we each have our own crosses to bear, right? So what I'm trying to explain to you here is, look, you're the 100 in 100,000 that are actually walking in righteousness, and that is quite the cross to bear. It's pretty heavy. You get Reese up here, who was pretty active in opening this morning, and you have her carry this thing, she's going to struggle. This thing's pretty heavy. And then you read sections of scripture like this. Oh yeah. That nonsense that horn spews from the Senate. That nonsense that horn spews from the medical communities. That nonsense that horn spews from academic institutions. That nonsense that horn is spewing at your job. That nonsense that horn is spewing in your own neighborhood. And for some of us, that nonsense that people in your own family, that horn is spewing. That's quite the weight. And God still wants you to do the right thing. And it's tough. And one of the things that keeps us going is we know righteousness is vindicated on Judgment Day. Verse 11, we keep looking. The sound of those boastful words. God didn't create the world. We evolved from monkeys. You don't have to be immersed for the forgiveness of your sins. Right? Sex and gender are two different competing ideologies, and one is a social construct. Right? And the beast was slain. Its body destroyed and given to the burning fire. That's what's happening in Daniel chapter 7. God's judgment on the beast. You jump up here to verse 9. Daniel wrote this for us, so this is him speaking here, and he says, I kept looking until thrones were set up. The Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. Main point of the vision here is the destruction of world government and the establishment that God's kingdom is eternal. If you actually jump down here to verse 18, it says, but the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, for all ages to come. See, that's the lesson here, is that the earth and its works will burn with an intense heat, but God's kingdom is eternal. If you turn on over to Revelation chapter 22, what do you think? Is this a pretty good reminder? The world's never concocted anything that would tempt you, right? There's nothing about the world that would maybe tempt you to want to be a part of it, right? Never. No. Yeah. Yeah, we only want the eternal kingdom. Yeah, you need this reminder, don't you? Let's stick with Jesus' kingdom, because this is the one that lasts forever, right? Because if you pick any other kingdom, it's going to be destroyed. But those kingdoms and all of their glory, like Satan offered Jesus, right? I mean, those are pretty tough to say no to. They come with quite the fame, power, affluence. They come with all sorts of things. And those are hard to say no to. You know what makes it easier to say no to those things? Sections like this in Daniel, when you realize, okay, that's right. Okay, I'm doing the right thing. It's really hard. It's the hardest thing ever, and it seems like everyone else around me is crazy, but it's worth it. It's worth it. Because doesn't Jesus tell us that this is one of the things that chokes out the seed? And it gets people. So this is a really great reminder. Just wanted to grab verse 5 here in Revelation 22. There will no longer be any night. There will no longer have need for the light of the lamp nor the light of the sun, because the Lord God will illumine them. I cannot wait for that. He goes on and says they will reign forever and ever. So Daniel 7, an introduction to the beasts. Why would we get another introduction to world kingdoms if we've already been introduced to them in Daniel chapter 2? Well, they're being introduced as critters, which do not have the ability to reason. And when you make yourself God, and you allow that gaze heavenward to come down and to become earthly, you become like an unreasoning animal. Okay? And when you do that, you've picked the wrong side. Judgment's coming. Okay? So that's the point here. Then God judges the earthly kingdom, specifically the fourth beast, okay, and then shows the establishment of his eternal kingdom. So back to verse 9 here in Daniel chapter 7. So Daniel's looking, and thrones are set up. So thrones are for kings, right? It's pretty cool that there's lots of thrones, though, because it's thrones plural. Right? I wonder who's sitting there with him. You know. We know the apostles. We know they're there, right? You know. Jesus says, "Do you not know that you will sit and judge the tribes of Israel?" Okay? Who else is told that they'll sit in the seat of judgment? 144,000. You just had to go and do it, didn't you?
Sorry.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. I mean, it's applicable, though, because this is where the Jehovah Witnesses in chapter 4 is where they get this whole idea. And then they went into that idea and then they just applied it. It just seemed to them like the 144,000 were the elect that, you know, so. Yeah. Well, we've been seated, you know. I mean, Paul even goes as far as to say, "Do you not know that you will judge angels?" Okay. So, yeah, there's thousands and thousands, myriads and myriads. And there's thrones set up. So thrones are for kings and, you know. Jesus is King of Kings, right? Who's the of kings? You ever thought about that? Yeah. King, prepositional phrase, of kings. You know. So if you were gonna diagram of kings, you know, where would you diagram that under? Say the word king. So who are the of kings? You. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. So, you know, and we read verse 18. We see that the saints of the Most Highest are there, right? So I'll just stop. But pretty cool. Now, the Ancient of Days takes his seat. So we've got to cover two things here. Who's the Ancient of Days and why is he sitting down? All right. Who's the Ancient of Days? You can't really get this one wrong. You could even give me a Bible a Sunday school answer if you wanted, it'd still be right. Jesus. Well, I mean he's here, right? But how do we know it's God? Near as I can tell, this title for God only shows up here in this chapter. It's not like you can go look up this Hebrew word and it's used in Exodus to describe God. So how do you look at this word only in the context and the only chapter that it appears in, and then come to the conclusion that it should be capitalized, like they did, and that it should be God? Probably 100 reasons, actually, how you could. But what's an obvious one? Rest of the context of the chapter. Absolutely. Now let's go even one step back out. What's his name? Ancient? Ancient? What does ancient mean? Like, really old? Like, really, really old? Isn't that a title only for God? Right? I'll actually skip through, you know, some of this, but Isaiah 9 calls him the eternal father. That's pretty ancient, right? You know, these poor kids, you know, they just love calling things ancient. Even though they're only talking about their, you know, 30 and 40-year-old parents, you know. You guys are so ancient, you know. You still drink black coffee, you know, but, you know, however that goes. But, hey, is eternal pretty ancient? Yeah, I mean, just the name itself. I mean, there's nobody that's more ancient than God. Okay? He just is. And wait a second. Isn't that his name? I am? He is? I mean, he just always has been. So there's nothing more ancient than that. there's lots of verses. The Bible repeatedly refers to him as being the first and the last. Okay? And then to Jared's comment, I mean, if you just read the rest of the chapter, it's pretty obvious that this is God. So let's move on. Why is he taking a seat? You know, I missed an opportunity. I should have had you all standing. You know, you guys want to stand up for a second? Yeah, go ahead and stand up. The Honorable Evangelist Toole. Oh, hey, careful, Kevin. Careful. You may be seated. And then what is the judge? Well, the people can sit when the judge sits. Oh, hopefully you've never been in a courtroom. Only as like a juror, right? Never as a defendant. Okay. Yeah. You can sit when the judge sits, right? Why does the judge sit? Because he's about to pronounce judgment. Okay. So the Ancient of Days, attended by myriads and thousands, okay, takes his seat because he's about to pronounce judgment. His vesture was like white snow, and his hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames, and its wheels were a burning fire. So, why the emphasis then on white and fire? We'll cover these separately. But we see an emphasis on white, right? And then we see an emphasis on fire. And then there's wheels. So if you really want to get your wheels spinning this morning, you go figure that one out from Ezekiel. Okay? I mean, I'll semi-explain it maybe today, but I already drug us through Ezekiel 17, okay? But that one's pretty cool. So, white, fire. Why is the judge white? Pure. So white typically communicates purity. Okay? So what you're seeing then is the judicial purity. Right? Now that's pretty important because if there's somebody who's put themselves in the position of judge, the hope would be that they're not doing the very thing that they're judging someone else to condemnation for. Would that make sense? Okay. That's a pretty important concept. Okay. Maybe take the log that's out of your eye before you try to judge the speck that's in your brother's eye. Okay. And just even from like, you know, speaking in terms of human relations, we wouldn't want, oh boy. I mean, you wouldn't want an unrighteous judge. I mean, we're full of them, right? And their pockets are being lined politically. But the goal is that the judge would be righteous. So that way his judgments would be righteous. So that's what you're seeing here by the white. That reminds me of Romans 3. We'll hit a couple verses here. We know this about God, but it is so, so important that God's plan is playing out this way. Not just for the sake of righteousness versus wickedness, but for even our confidence of faith. And I hope that we can see that here in a minute. Romans chapter 3. We'll just grab verse 26. For the demonstration, I say, of his righteousness at the present time, so that he would be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. That's very, very important. Okay, that he is just and the justifier. So, you've got a judge, and he puts a line down the middle, and he says, y'all are right, the rest of you are wrong. Okay? And the people on the right side of the judge's judgment are saying, boy, we're feeling pretty good about ourselves. This is pretty great. And the people on the other side of God's judgment are feeling what? They're feeling wronged. Wronged, right? Well, that's not fair. You know, why does Bob get to play more minutes than I do? That's not fair. I'm a way better player. You know, but the judge has spoken. Okay, Timmy's better than you. Okay, well, that's not fair. So when God gives his righteous judgment and he splits it down the middle, okay, and he puts the sheep on the right and puts the sheep on the right and the goats on the left, right? Are the people on the left going to be saying this isn't fair? You ever thought about it? They're going to be complaining. They might be in agony. But is it unjust? It's not. Because they will see him as he is. Yeah, I'll do that this morning for the message. Because when the earth and its works burn, the only thing that survives are the spirits of mankind. And those who aren't on the right side of God's judgment do not have God's spirit, right? And doesn't Romans say it's his spirit with our spirit that declares we're sons of God? And it's Jesus who clothes us that forgives us of our sins, yes? So those people who don't have God's spirit are still in their sins. And when the earth and its works burn with an intense heat, and the actual literal there, which is so cool in 2 Peter, exposed, you will see the souls of men wrapped in their sin. And when they see that, and then they see the Ancient of Days, who is righteousness, that is not an adjective describing God. Do we understand that? That is not an adjective. He is it. It's him. And then when you see adjectives flowing, it's flowing from him because that's who he is. So when the souls of mankind who are still in their sins and they do not have Jesus' spirit with their spirit, and then they see righteousness himself in the spiritual realm in Daniel chapter 7, ain't nobody going to be saying, well, this isn't fair. Because they're going to see the spiritual realm and they're going to see wickedness with their own spiritual eyes. And they're going to know what they have done. Right? Because typically, when a judgment is made, hello, y'all have, you know, brothers and sisters, you know. Well, why does he get to sit up front and I don't? That never happened to you, right? Martin, you guys never argued for the front seat, right? Maybe. Those Martin kids are pretty good kids, so they might never have actually argued over the front seat. But you see the picture, though, right? And when you're on the wrong side of that and you don't get what you want, it isn't fair. How important is it that the judge is just and the justifier? That's pretty important, right? So, now we got to make sure that we understand this before we move on. When Romans says that Jesus is your justifier, what does he mean by that? If you've ever done something and then, let's say, your parents said you shouldn't have done that, and you then tried to justify your actions, what were you doing? You were being told you were in the wrong, but you were trying to put yourself in a position of being right based on whatever evidence you can provide. That's what justifying means. So if you're trying to justify your actions, you know, Sue's at the bus stop, it's been 5 minutes. How long are you actually allowed to wait before you get to move the bus down the road? Okay, so if you ain't there at departure time, she puts the pedal back to the metal, blows a puff of smoke into the air, you know, ruins the climate, and then, you know, as a complete joke, you know, and then just keeps the baby, you know, chugging down the road, right? Well, I was late because my mom didn't make my favorite kind of cereal. And so I had to make my own breakfast. And Sue's like, I'm sorry. You're not justified. I can't justify it. Because if I did that for you, then I'd have to do it for everybody. And this bus would never make it to school. You see the point? Justify means to put yourself in a position of being right, even though you're accused of being wrong. Hey, spiritually speaking, can every single one of us in this room be accused of wrong? Yes. Where is that verse in Romans that says all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God? It's in the chapter we're in. Romans 3, right? You see how this verse fits in its context now? Every one of you sinned. You're in the wrong. And you're like, God, but mommy didn't make me my favorite kind of cereal. Well, that ain't going to work. That was the law, right? But then Jesus comes, right, on his throne, dies for your sins, pays the price so that you can go from being wrong to being right. Doesn't he see we are the righteousness of God in him? So how did you become right? Well, not of your own doing, which is why Paul would ask a pretty important question to the Galatians. Having begun by the Spirit, are you now being perfected by the law? Foolish Galatians, right? So the only reason you went from being wrong, which we all were, all have sinned, to being in any sort of position where we're actually justified isn't because we're making excuses, because the Father paid the price for us. So he is the justifier. Now that's the gospel. And that's a very, very good thing. But he is also just. He is just and the justifier. So we call it the justice department, right? The people who issue out the verdicts, the people who issue out the judgments. It's the justice department because they're just. So is Jesus just in his judgment? Are those who are on the wrong side of his judgment being unfairly treated? Because he's just. You see that? But he's also justifier. Because you got two people and they're goats and sheep and they've all sinned, but one group's justified and the other one's just in their judgment and condemnation. You see how important that is? Okay, so we'll turn to Daniel 7. We'll see how quick you can do it. We're at the top of the hour here. Verse 9, so there's the white, and we got a few verses we'll hit next week to kind of, because there's some really cool stuff in Psalms and Isaiah about the righteous judge we definitely want to hit. But then it also has this big emphasis on fire, right? What do you think fire represents? I mean, Jesus even talks about a baptism of fire, right? I'm trying to think. There's this pesky chapter in verse in Hebrews. Is there a chapter in Hebrews that we should know really well in this congregation? Probably chapter 12. But not because of heavenly Jerusalem and Mount Zion, right? Because there's something else in Hebrews 12 that has to do with fire. Thanks for your attention.